the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel, Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the Gospel of Luke. Let's join Pastor Sandy in the Gospel of Luke chapter 20, verse 20.
One of my favorite all-time movies is The Shootist. Anybody ever seen The Shootist? Oh yeah, it was John Wayne's final film. You see, Wayne plays a gunfighter who's dying of cancer, and this gunslinger decides to exit the world on his own terms. He invites his three opponents, the three villains, to meet him at high noon at the Metropole, the town saloon. He's going to leave this world on his birthday. It all happens on his birthday. He's going to leave on the same day that he entered. Well, it's a classic shootout. There in the Metropole, the old Duke, he guns down all three bad guys, and he goes out in a blaze of glory. It's a showdown for the ages. And that is exactly what we have here in Luke chapter 20. For Jesus, too, orchestrates a showdown with three villains. Notice verse 1 of chapter 20, he deals with the chief priests and the scribes and the Jewish elders. On Sunday, he sent them an invitation of sorts. By driving the money changers out of the temple, Jesus had upset their power and their profits. Surely they would want to confront him the next day there in the temple on Monday. And it was a theological shootout. The Jews will squeeze off questions intended to trap Jesus. He's going to return fire with wisdom from above. And when the smoke clears, the bad guys will be humiliated and Jesus will be glorified by all. Well, the action starts here in verse 20 of chapter 20. So the Jews watched him and sent spies who pretended to be righteous that they might seize on his words in order to deliver him to the power and the authority of the governor. They wanted Jesus to slip up and say something that would be offensive to the Romans. That way they could let Pilate do their dirty work. Well, then they asked him, saying, "Teacher, we know that you say and teach rightly, and you do not show personal favoritism, but teach the way of God in truth." Now they're coming on to him. This is sort of some phony flattery. These Jews plan to butter him up, and then they're going to stab him with the butter knife. That's what's going to happen. They're going to try to catch Jesus off guard. And here comes their first trap, verse 22. "Is it lawful for us to pay taxes to Caesar or not?" Now, this was a hot topic within Jewish circles. You see, the Roman poll tax was an existence tax. The assumption was that the right to life was given by Rome. This flew in the face of the Bible. God is the author of life. Either a yes or no answer could get Jesus into trouble. You see, if he said yes, pay your taxes, the Jews then could portray him as a traitor, as a Roman collaborator. You see, Orthodox Jews would have even accused him of committing idolatry. Since the emperor claimed to be God, and since his image were on their coins, some hardcore Jews believed to pay taxes was to pay homage to an idol. On the other hand, if Jesus said, "No, don't pay your tax," then they could turn around and they could report him to the Romans. They could accuse him of treason. You see, Rome was tolerant of divergent religious beliefs, but it was unbending when it came to political loyalty. And so in their Jewish minds, they thought this was the perfect question to trap Jesus. Verse 23, "But he perceived their craftiness and said to them," he knew they were up to something, "and he said to them, 'Why do you test me? Show me a denarius.'" This was a small silver coin, about the size of a dime. Jesus asks, "Whose image and inscription does it have?" And they answered and said, "Caesar's." On one side of this coin, there's a picture, there's a bust of the Roman emperor. The caption below it reads, "Tiberius Caesar, son of the divine Augustus." On the other side were the words, "Pontiff Maximus," which is Latin for high priest. Obviously, this coin was dedicated to the emperor. So Jesus said to them, "Render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God, the things that are God's. And notice their reaction. But they could not catch him in his words and in the presence of the people, and they marveled at his answer and kept silent. And did you know 2,000 years later, we are still marveling at his answer? I love author Kent Hughes' comment on this verse. He says, "The statement of our Lord was not only astounding the instant it was uttered, but it is even today universally acclaimed to be the single most influential political statement ever made in the history of the world." You see, in the ancient world, coins were understood to be the property of the person whose image was on them. Thus, Jesus is saying, if this is Caesar's coin, well, then just give it back to Caesar. That's no big deal. But while you're at it, give to God what belongs to God. And where do we find the image of God? Hey, it's stamped in the life of each one of us. Men and women, man was made in the image and likeness of God. Thus, Jesus is saying, hey, give your coins to Caesar, but give your life to God. In amazing brevity, Jesus affirms both the validity and the limits of human government. God is the supreme authority, and yet government has its place. The Caesar in Rome had the right to lay claim to a person's money, to a citizen's money in the form of taxes. But God has the right to lay claim to our very lives. Round one of this final showdown goes to Jesus. Verse 27. Then some of the Sadducees who deny that there is a resurrection came to him. Now, in the first century among Jewish leaders, there were two major sects. There was the Pharisees, and then there were the Sadducees. The Pharisees were the conservatives, the right-wingers. The Sadducees were the liberals. They were the left-wingers. The Sadducees only considered the first five books of the Law of Moses to be inspired by God. The rest of the Old Testament, they didn't put on the same par. They denied the existence of angels, that they didn't believe in the afterlife, and they didn't believe in the resurrection of the dead. Of course, that's why they were sad, you see. These were the Sadducees who launched this second attack. Well, they asked him, saying, "Teacher, Moses wrote to us that if a man's brother dies having a wife and he dies without children, his brother should take his wife and raise up offspring for his brother." This was the law of the Levirate. Levir is Latin for brother-in-law. Deuteronomy 25 details this custom. If a man died, his brother was to marry the widow and Sarah's son to carry on his brother's name. You remember, this is the law that's the backdrop of the book of Ruth we've been studying on Sunday mornings. Verse 29, they continue the story. Now there were seven brothers, and the first took a wife and died without children. And the second took her as wife, and he died childless. Then the third took her. This is a persistent family. And in like manner, the seven also. And they left no children and died. The scenario reminds me of the woman who called her husband Henry. Why? Because he was the eighth. Oh my. Ever heard of the woman who thought she could have 16 husbands? She thought she could have 16 husbands. She heard the pastor say, four better, four worse, four richer, four poorer. At least this hypothetical wife in the story stopped at seven. You know, if this woman had actually existed, she probably would have been on the Jerry Springer show. I mean, this is a bizarre story. I'm sure Nancy Grace would have wanted to do an interview. She would have asked what she had against women, why she's killed off seven brothers. By the way, did you hear about the gal? She had this dream. An angel appeared to her. He announced, he said, "Prepare yourself for widowhood. Your husband is about to die a violent death." The woman responded, "I've got just one question. Will I be acquitted?" Well, here too is a woman who had it in for husbands. Well, the Sadducees, they finished their tale in verse 32. "Last of all, the woman died also. Therefore, in the resurrection, whose wife does she become? For all seven had her as wife. And I'm sure the Sadducees, they were snickering even as they posed the question. They didn't even believe in the resurrection. Well, Jesus answered and said to them, "The sons of this age marry and are given in marriage. But those who are counted worthy to attain that age and the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage." Wow. And if you're in a good marriage, you probably take this as bad news. Whereas if you're in a bad marriage, you've just breathed a sigh of relief. This isn't going to last forever. You know, marriage was created as a portrait of Jesus' relationship with his church. In heaven, we'll still be intimate with other humans. Probably the most casual friendship in heaven will be more heartfelt than the deepest marriage here on earth. But there'll be no marriages among humans in heaven. The dominant relationship in heaven will be our marriage to Jesus. Our marriage to the Master is the featured attraction in heaven. The depth and intimacy we'll enjoy with Jesus will make human marriages unnecessary. Well, Jesus adds, "Nor can they die anymore, for they are equal to the angels and are sons of God, being sons of the resurrection." Angels are immortal. They never die. And in this respect, humans are equal. We'll also live forever. Notice Jesus calls us sons of the resurrection. One day we'll receive resurrected bodies. We'll no longer be subject to decay. You know, our bodies will take on a spiritual, unlimited potentials. You know, whenever an astronaut goes up into space, he has a spacesuit on. Why? Because these bodies aren't conditioned for the environment of space. Likewise, these bodies aren't conditioned for the environment of heaven. That's why when we go to heaven, we'll need new bodies, resurrected bodies. As Paul wrote to the Corinthians, these mortal bodies will put on immortality. Well, verse 37, "But even Moses showed in the burning bush passage that the dead are raised when he called the Lord the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. For he is not the God of the dead, but of the living, for all live to him." Now, Jesus could have quoted numerous passages to prove that the Old Testament taught the resurrection of the dead. But remember, the Sadducees, they only considered the first five books of the Old Testament to be inspired by God. And this is why Jesus takes his argument from Moses and from Exodus 3 at the burning bush. And here's his logic. If God is the God of the living, which God said he was, and he's also the God of Abraham, which God said he was, what does that mean? That means that a 2,200-year-old Abe must still be alive and kicking. That's his logic. Well, verse 37, "Then some of the scribes answered and said, 'Teacher, you have spoken well.' But after that, they dared not question him anymore." Hey, spiritual six-shooters have been blazing in the temple. Religious people are dead to rights. Jesus is the shootist still standing. But before he sticks his gun back in his holster, he has a question of his own. And he said to them, "How can they say that the Christ is the son of David?" Now, the word Christ or Christos is the Greek form of the Hebrew word Messiah. In Jewish theology, Messiah meant God's anointed. The Messiah was the eternal king who would come to establish Israel as an eternal kingdom. But there was an apparent contradiction that the Jewish theologians had not addressed. And Jesus points it out by quoting David in Psalm 110, verse 1. He says, "Now David himself said in the book of Psalms, 'The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool.' Therefore, David calls him Lord. How is he then his son?" 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 12 made it clear that the Messiah would be the descendant of David. And yet David called the Messiah his Lord. King David had many sons, but he only had one Lord. I mean, the only person greater than the king is who? God. God was David's Lord. He had many sons, but he only had one Lord. And so Jesus is asking the obvious question. If Messiah is supposed to be David's Lord, and yet he's David's son, how can that be? Unless David's son is also God. That was the big issue. The Jews, you see, they saw the Messiah in human terms. They saw him only as the son of David, not the Lord of David. But they needed to reconsider. They needed to consider that he was more than man. And Jesus introduces a concept that the Jews had overlooked, the deity of the Messiah, that the Christ was God. Their traditions about the Messiah were wrong. Jesus tries to take them back to Scripture, but they refuse to go. At this point, they stop questioning Jesus, but sadly, they never questioned their own assumptions. They were wrong about the Messiah. The Messiah was not only a man, he was also God. Well, the Jews, they grilled Jesus on Monday. On Thursday, they're going to kill him. Well, after this shootout with the Jews, Jesus fires off one more round. Verse 45. Then in the hearing of all the people, he said to his disciples, "Beware of the scribes." Those are the ones he's just dealt with. "Who desire to go around in long robes, love greetings in the marketplaces, the best seats in the synagogues, and the best places at feasts. But they devour widows' houses, and for a pretense, they make long prayers. These will receive greater condemnation." The leaders of Judaism, they were just hypocrites. They were all show and no substance. Oh, they dressed the part, and they talked the part, and they played the part. But they preyed on innocent folks, and they made a mockery of true prayer. And in chapter 21, Jesus spots a few of these same guys that he's just described. And he looked up, and he saw the rich putting their gifts into the treasury. Now, in the temple, there were 13 offering boxes. And they were shaped like upside-down trumpets or upside-down megaphones. Each box accumulated money for a different purpose. The rich, when they came in to drop their money in the offering box, they would make a pompous show. They would have people blowing trumpets and playing music. They would have a big introduction. They would have all this attention. They gave to God in order to attract attention from men. That was their motive. But Jesus could care less about these guys. In fact, his eyes were focused elsewhere. And he saw also a certain poor widow putting in 2 mites. This rich man was dropping his big offering in the pot. But this widow, she only had 2 little coins, 2 mites, he calls them. The mite was the Jewish lepta. It was worth about 1/8 of a cent. So if you put 2 of them together, you still only got 1/4 of a penny. Heard the old phrase, "I don't have enough to rub 2 pennies together"? Well, this isn't even 2 pennies. 2 mites. From a strict monetary viewpoint, these 2 mites were an inconsequential offering. And yet Jesus saw it differently. And so he said, "Truly I say to you that this poor widow has put in more than all. For all these out of their abundance have put in offerings for God. But she out of her poverty put in all the livelihood that she had." You know, human judgment measures the value of an offering by the amount that's given. But Jesus measures it by the amount that's left over. You know, we humans, we focus on the portion of the gift, but Jesus sees the proportion. Most people just tip God from their surplus. You know, few people know the joy of really giving. Really giving. Real giving digs deep. As David said, "Nor will I offer burnt offerings to the Lord my God with that which costs me nothing." So many of us, we give to God, but really, it doesn't cost us anything. We're not really giving. We're just tipping. From week to week, do you give to God? Really give to God, or do you merely just slip him a tip? Well, verse 5, then as some spoke of the temple, how it was adorned, I'm going to get this verse right. Then as some spoke of the temple, how it was adorned with beautiful stones and donations. And of course, the temple was indeed a sight to behold. Josephus, the Jewish historian, he left us an eyewitness description of the temple there in Jerusalem. Listen to these words. He said, the exterior of the temple lacked nothing. It astounded both mind and eye. For being covered on all sides with massive plates of gold, the sun was no sooner up that it radiated so fiery a flash that persons straining to look at it were compelled to avert their eyes as from solar rays. To approaching strangers, it appeared from a distance like a snow-clad mountain, for all that was not overlaid with gold was purest white. The temple was colossal. It was beautiful. And of the donations here that Jesus mentions, King Herod gave a golden vine with clusters of grapes as tall as a man that adorned the doors of the temple. The Egyptian king Ptolemy donated a golden desk for the temple precincts. The temple and its amenities were a reason to rave. But Jesus said, these things which you see, the days will come in which not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be thrown down. And his prediction came true when Rome sacked Jerusalem in 70 AD. In fact, during the siege of the city, one of the soldiers violated his orders and threw a torch into the temple. It caught fire, and it melted the golden plates that adorned the outer walls. In fact, liquid gold ran down into the crevices between the stones that made up the temple. And thus, the greedy Romans, they toppled the stones over to retrieve the gold. It fulfilled Jesus' prophecy. Not one stone shall be left upon another. You can go to Jerusalem today and you can see the stones that were thrown down off the top of the temple. And so they ask him, saying, teacher, but when will these things be? And what sign will there be when these things are about to take place? Now, in Matthew's account, the disciples expand on these questions. For at this time, they also ask about the signs of Jesus' coming and the end of the age, the last days. What are the signs? That's the scope of his discussion now in the next few verses. Verse 8. And he said, take heed that you do not be deceived. For many will come in my name, saying, I am he, and the time is drawn near. Therefore, do not go after them. Now, here's the first mark on the timeline. There will be false Christs and false claims. He says, but don't panic. In this present age, the age of man, spiritual deception will be the status quo. There'll be these false Christs and false claims. You'll see it. But then things will start to heat up. He says, when you hear of wars and commotions, do not be terrified. Once again, that's the status quo on planet Earth. But these things must come to pass, but the end will not come immediately. I mean, here's another precursor. Military conflict. Mass chaos. I mean, what else do you expect from a world that rejects the Prince of Peace? But war, commotion. Chaos and conflict become run of the mill when you run from God's will. That's what he's saying. Verse 10, but then he said to them, nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. You see, wars are not a sign in and of themselves, but when they start to be fought on a global scale, this is the first sign that the end is near.
Our greatest calling in life is to be more like Jesus, and the Gospels are the single best place to learn more about how our Savior lived on this earth. Studying the Gospels gives us examples of how to live by the power of God's Spirit. Each day, Pastor Sandy will be teaching through the Gospel of Luke with hopes that we'll grow to be more like Jesus. This has been another edition of Sandy Adams Radio with our pastor and teacher, Sandy Adams. Sandy is the senior pastor of Calvary Chapel in Atlanta, Georgia. Now, we're sure that today's message in Luke has blessed and encouraged you in your walk with Jesus Christ. Maybe you'd like to review this message again, or perhaps a family member or friend has come to mind today. Log on to sandyadams.org and click on the radio program option in the main menu. There you'll find today's message. All you need to do is remember today's date and log on to sandyadams.org and then click on the radio program option from the main menu. Or you can give us a call here at the church. Our phone number is 770-736-2828. That's 770-736-2828. Someone is standing by to take your order. Again, just mention today's date and we'll send you the full-length CD. In the next edition, Pastor Sandy will continue to take us through the Gospel of Luke. On behalf of Pastor Sandy and the entire production team, we want to say thank you for tuning in and may God bless you.